This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zympht. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's your old pal Benjamin the Donkey, back again with more Limericks of Doom.
Hi, Benji. Yeah, I know, it's been too long since I've released a Sequitur show. But you know, my life has been totally unmanageable in preparation and recovery from a week-long, long-distance bus trip on a rather unpleasant bit of family business.
You know, Doomer forums can help. Sanity's defined by the norm, so there's pressure on you to conform. You're crazy? That's rumors. Hang here with your doomers and watch from the eye of the storm. A doom forum's good for your brain. When you're freaking, it helps you maintain. Regular attendance can lead to dependence, but at least you won't go insane. Folks who talk doom quite a lot stay sane while they study fate's plot. To make it apparent that you're not aberrant, try talking with folks who do not. Hee-haw!
You nailed it. I had two obstacles. One is that I don't have on-demand access to the internet when I'm traveling. And the other is that for sure I talk to too many crazy people. Folks who are deeply into denial, or worse perhaps, so deeply into the blame game that they don't understand that the innocent will be just as extinct as the guilty.
Vengeance. All the oppressors you knew, and whose torment you had to live through, and who filled you with dread, well, soon they'll be dead. On the other hand, you'll be dead too.
All I can say to them is what my former beloved used to say to me. Have fun being right. And they do have fun, that is. Anyway, please accept my heartfelt congratulations on the publication of Limericks of Doom 2. And thanks for taking time out from your book signing tour to talk with me today on Sequitur All Souls.
Writing my way to acceptance. Writing is mostly my way of coming to terms with dismay. So the more I accept and get mentally prepped, the less it seems I've got to say.
It didn't take much artistry for me to spin that limerick to make it true for me. Talking is mostly my way of coming to terms with dismay. So the more I accept and get mentally prepped, the less, it seems, I've got to say.
Hee-haw!
Hee-haw indeed. On top of exhaustion and depression from my recent bus trip, I find myself feeling like a broken record. Like it's all been said before, by me and by others, suddenly too numerous to count. The other reason I've got less to say these days is that the language is becoming so degenerate. When I read your limerick anticipatory or preparatory grief, I was reminded of a recent presentation by Guy McPherson in which he spoke of the absurdity of the notion of pre-boarding. By some magical process, some privileged passengers are allowed to get on the airplane before they get on the airplane? Guy finds that absurdity worthy of George Carlin, may he rest in peace. So, how much do we have to stretch our concept of grief to include our emotional reaction to a tragedy that hasn't happened yet?
Our preps include psychic numbing, a kind of emotion down dumbing. We use it as pre-PTSD, and we hope it helps deal with what's coming.
So the next revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual should include PPTSD, pre-post-traumatic stress disorder. Say what? If the trauma hasn't happened yet, why not just call it dread or anxiety?
Hee-haw!
In order to give our listeners a sense of the artistry involved in creating your limericks, let's have a look at one of your longer works. Even your title is a parody, The Blind Men Were Irrelevant. Here is the fable of The Blind Men and the Elephant, as rendered in an 8-verse poem by mid-19th century poet John Godfrey Saxe. The Blind Men and the Elephant. It was 6 men of Indostan, to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling of the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me 'tis mighty clear, this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "E'en the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can, this marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope, then seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indostan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right, and all were in the wrong.
The blind men were irrelevant. 6 Douchestan men had in mind that extinction's cause they would find. They thought that through thinking they'd see their cares shrinking despite being mentally blind. The first, the bag he was in, had a heavy religious spin. So the reason he picked wasn't hard to predict. The problem was all due to sin. The second spake, "We're going to tank because our economy shrank. The future's not sunny, the reason is money, and everyone trying to make bank." The third said, "We're going to expire from advances we didn't require, like the planting of plants. Now we're pooping our pants due to agriculture and fire." The fourth quoth, "We're feeling bereft from oppression and government theft. The reason things bite, we're too far to the right, or maybe too far to the left." The fifth declared, "Life is complex, and we're into it up to our necks. Our species extender lies trapped within gender. The problem is all due to sex." The sixth opined, "We're down the drain, and the reason is perfectly plain. Folks are totally nuts, their heads up their butts, they're psycho and crazy insane." So each man played with his dong, and disputed on whose was most long. Each thought he was right, but that changed not their plight, which made them all fatally wrong.
It's an amazing piece of work. You captured not only the overall semantic structure of the tale, even though the poetic structure of a limerick is totally different, but you even employed some of the exact same devices and archaic expressions. And you twisted the ending just enough to keep it from being an exact quote. Can you give me and give our listeners any insight into the creative process that goes into the production of such a work? What was it about that 19th century poem that prompted your muse to step up with the motivation for a parody? And where do the ideas come from? In other words, what was it that determined what drivers of extinction your mock analysts would address?
The idea of the parody is something I did an awful lot of. When I first started writing these, I thought of it as sort of like practice, you know, like art students used to copy the old masters, you know. I mean, I've liked that poem, the original poem, since I was a kid. I mean, look at the table of contents of Limericks of Doom 2 at the longer words, okay, where this blind men were irrelevant appears. The first item is nothing don't matter no more. I hate to admit this because nobody has picked up on it on their own, which frankly was a kind of an exercise on Bob Dylan. Doomer desiderata obviously is that famous desiderata thing that's been hanging on walls ever since the 60s.
Go and placidly, blah, 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 blah.
Exactly. Yeah. And that also follows very closely the original. The Pre-Doomer's Guide was consciously written as a takeoff on a book promotion. This book will solve all of your problems, so, you know, buy it immediately. That was sort of like a spoof as well. There's a lot of them in there. Playground does a lot of takeoff on Lord of the Flies.
You know? Yes.
And really, as a creative endeavor, and not that I'm any kind of writing expert, but for me, it's pretty easy. Once you decide on where you're going to go with it, and that decision comes early because it's going to be about doom, you know, so that decision doesn't take any work, then it's largely just a matter of filling out the blanks.
Okay, well, doom is a great big broad subject area, and you had to select six doom drivers for your six irrelevant men to talk about. How did you make such a very diverse selection? I mean, the selection of drivers is as diverse as the parts of the elephant.
Yeah, that's something that I'm not really good at doing, is making comprehensive lists. I'm terrible at that. So as I remember it just off the top of my head, the way I did this was I just thought of what different schools of thought might say about it, and not in any organized way. And I just hoped that I got enough and I got good ones and I didn't leave out anything too important, because I always have trouble with that kind of project. It worked out pretty well. And yes, you mentioned the twist at the end. Well, I just had to put a little bit of smut in there, didn't I?
But I'm talking about the very last line where we conclude that, you know, they were all a little bit right, but in total completely wrong. That's exactly like the original.
Absolutely.
It's only a very slight spin.
Yes, exactly. And for example, I did one on the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner, and of course it ends up a sadder and wiser man, you know, he woke them with more and more. You want to get those familiar lines in there, you know what I mean? So they're fun to do, and like I say, they kind of write themselves once you get it geared up, because they don't take much thinking. They don't take original thought. They take... They take thinking to meld it with something else, like, you know, and so on. There's some creativity in it, but it's not like trying to think up something from scratch or trying to deal with some kind of problem in Doom that hasn't been addressed very well yet, something like that. That's much harder.
Mm-hmm. On a related note, Have you noticed the corporate media is moving to acceptance of our central position in the sixth extinction? Too bad they're still talking about the end of the century, by which time I'll be grateful to be long dead.
Though we die, after death we'll still be part of all of the glory we see. I'm hoping this view might prove helpful to you, 'cause it hasn't done too much for me. Finding joy in doom. We're fucked. Words have never been truer. Day by day, we'll likely get bluer. But there's joy, we could say, that with each passing day, the ones still remaining are fewer. Hee-haw!
Yes. As my friend Savannah Bob Nelson likes to say, it won't be as long as it's been. But while you are rivaled perhaps only by the Swami Beyond Ananda at bringing levity to our gravity, Elizabeth West is rivaled by none when it comes to accessing joy internally in the face of doom through her sunset windows practices. Let's listen together to Drawing Joy.
Hi, Susan. I'm excited about this sunset window, Drawing Joy, that I'm offering today. It's one that's been really fascinating for me to play with, and I'm looking forward to sharing it with you. It actually is designed to connect form and formlessness, or that's what I find it to do. And each time you link the two, form and formlessness, you bring a spark of the eternal and the divine into everyday life. There are millions of ways to actually create that moment, to instigate it, to coax it into being, that opening between realities. And this week's sunset window is just one of those. Obviously, as I've said before, some of these suggestions are going to resonate more deeply with some of you, which is why there's a range of avenues that are on offer here. So if you feel moved to, try this one. And if you find that it works for you, continue with it. Your energy, both as it fills and surrounds you, and as it reaches beyond you to touch other forms of consciousness, both human and non-human, animated and not, is central to how you experience yourself in a given moment and how you perceive the world and your relationship to it. You know this. You wake up grumpy or sad or excited or full of love, and that initial state often can color your entire day. You go out into the world filled with gratitude, which spills into smiles at passersby, and you get back that energy at least twice over most of the time. Not always, but often. On the other hand, you know, the toast burns, the pants you just put on have a stain and you hadn't noticed it, you're late and you're sure that everyone is annoyed with you, and it just goes on from there. So the energy that you carry with you through your day comprises a number of components. Some are obviously beyond your control, but many of them are in your hands. And this practice provides a simple and concrete means to shape those elements that are indeed in your hands. And this one may be appealing to anyone who is visually inclined. You may need a few moments to gather your supplies at the outset, but going forward, this should only take 5 minutes or so every day to work with, as is generally the case with these sunset windows. This is how it works. You need to have on hand some white paper and some drawing instruments. Colored crayons or pencils or markers are ideal if you have them, but if you only have a pen or pencil, you can still do this. You'll be making a picture, and so you need the means to make the picture, the paper and the drawing instrument, and you also need a means for affixing that picture to a mirror or refrigerator somewhere where you'll see it throughout the day. Tape or push pins would be helpful. So that's the first thing, get your supplies. And once you've got them, you begin by sitting quietly, and doing this first thing in the morning is ideal. And you envision the energy that you would like to carry throughout your day. So close your eyes and just look to see a shape, a color, a movement. Doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, it's probably best if it's not. Just allow what arises. Don't censor yourself at all. Stay simple. With your eyes closed, look for what first appears, either in your mind's eye or in your heart. It might be a geometric shape like a circle or a diamond. It might be a bird on the wing, a fountain, a tree, a great heart, an opening flower. Oftentimes, what will arise will be fairly symbolic. So without getting fussy about it, just notice colors and movement in your shape. Notice what makes you feel good and right. And your heart will tell you when you've got it. And then you take that simple shape and you translate it onto paper. This shouldn't take very long. It's not about creating a piece of artwork at all. It's about concretizing the energetic impulse you chose for your day. You don't have to be good at drawing, nor do you have to have expensive supplies. Just bring that picture of the energy that you wish to hold on this day into this dimension. Try not to think as you draw in shade, but rather to feel the energies that you are deliberately calling up and putting onto paper. Feel the field that you are drawing for yourself. And then once you've done that, intend that you carry the energy foremost during the day and put the drawing on your refrigerator, your bathroom mirror, your computer, somewhere that you're going to see it during the day, and agree to allow this representation of your intention to just hold you throughout the day. And then finally, as is often the case with these exercises, at the end of the day, before you sleep, just take a moment or two to consider the relationship between the energy you drew and your day, your interactions, your experience of yourself and the world. Writing a sentence or two might be a good idea. You can even write it on the back of the drawing if you want. And that's it. We are, Susan, so powerful, and yet we so often abdicate our power. This world is a place of marvels and things of extraordinary beauty, all of us, at least at times, being foremost amongst them. Please, 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 I want to urge people to give themselves permission to live in that marvelous beauty more of the time, to be aware of all the brightness that lies both within us and without us, and of the living bridge that ties those brightnesses together. And this is just a means of connecting what is within and what is without, of making what we long for, what we see real in our life day to day. So try it if you're interested, if it appeals. Now, as always, Susan, I'm going to share some of my experiences with this particular practice. I've learned a few things that I thought I'd pass along in case anyone decides to try it. First off, practically speaking, I cut some regular 8.5 by 11 scrap paper, you know, stuff with writing on the other side, into quarters. And I used one a day, nothing fancy at all. And I've enjoyed doing the drawings with crayons. I love color, so that's been an important aspect of the pictures of the energy that I see and want to anchor for my day. Color is really, I don't know, it's just a really important thing in my life. So the crayons have been important, but you know, if that's not what you're getting, if you're more motion-oriented, a pencil or a pen might work fine. I've also discovered that, and this was just my experience, but when I have drawn something with very clear lines and borders, which a pen would tend to push you in the direction of, I have actually felt isolated or cut off, frustrated, or as if I'm going to explode, like my energy is being contained or restrained. The first day's drawing, which I believe is on the webpage, was a golden circle. And the original impression that I had was that I wanted to be floating in an orb of gold, but I also felt that there was this green container. So I drew that, but it actually left me feeling locked in this green container. It was awful. I had a terrible day. So it was interesting for me because it demonstrated for me the power of this practice because I didn't get it right. I didn't get the drawing right. So I was able over a period of time to use the crayons to soften the edges of the forms that I was seeing. Opening up the form opened up my energies and allowed me to feel freer, more expansive, and overall more joyful, which generally speaking is what I'm looking for. A beautiful day arose actually from a fairly unappealing and unpleasing drawing aesthetically. It was a bright fountain I saw in the morning when I sat. It was gorgeous. But when I drew it, it looked like Cousin It. more than it looked like a fountain of light. But what I captured was the movement, and I really had a wonderful time with the energy. So, you know, my picture totally sucked. But what I did was manage to take the energies, which were very, very enlivening and delightful, and I put them on paper, and I flowed with those energies all day. So I've noticed a clear correlation in my life over the past few days of working with this between the energies that I drew and the ones that I was able to live. But I've had to watch the process to see the subtleties of the process. You know, I've had to keep adjusting and keep watching to see how what I do in the morning affects what happens to me during the day. I have seen that what I put on paper tends to manifest better than I might have imagined. And so as the time that I've worked with this has gone on, I've become more adept at visioning the energy accurately and then living it. So it's been a fun one for me.
Cool. Well, that was fun. As I was sitting here recording this, I was working along with you. I didn't draw, but I certainly did have a very clear vision. My vision was more animated rather than shape or an object. It was actually an animate being.
Uh-huh.
And when I encountered it, I asked it the standard question, are you my power animal? And it laughed at me. So I guess it's not my power animal. I guess it's just the energy that I want to have in my day, as you were describing. Mm-hmm. It was a strange sort of, what do they call that when more than one species gets mingled? Is that a chimera?
Yes.
Yes, it was a chimera. The body of the being was sensuous. I'm not sure if it was feline or serpentine, but it was very, you know, flowing, sensuous, strong sort of energy to it. But the face, the head and the face was more like that of a rat. It had beady eyes and pointed nose and wiggly whiskers. I mean, going, going, going. And so I'm holding both the sensuous, languorous, relaxedness of the cat snake body with the inquisitive, energetic rat face head in the same being. And so that's the energy that I would love to see, that kind of combination of energies, more of that in my life. So maybe after we finish our session here, maybe I'll try to draw it. I don't know. It's kind of complicated drawing for somebody as unartistic as I am.
Well, remember though, Susan, that the point is not to render this in a way that anybody else can relate to it. It's just for you.
I felt so liberated when you talked about doing it on a quarter sheet.
Yeah, this is simply taking that energy and bringing it into the three-dimensional realm. So it's solely for yourself. And like I said, you know, my fountain, it looked like Cousin It. It's ridiculous looking. And yet I recognized in it the vision that I had, the original impulse. So all it did was every time I saw it, it would recall for me that original experience, right?
So I was thinking that very thing, that the body of this being could be just a curved line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the head, I would have to represent the beady eyes, the pointed nose, and the spiky whiskers, but it really doesn't matter.
No, this is about just pulling that energy through your body and allowing it to be in your world, you know, on your computer. One of the things that is so hard about being human, I think, is that we forget. We forget so much that is true. So much of the time, and allowing ourselves to have the tools to remember is a really big piece of staying conscious and of doing what we want to do with our lives. Well, I'll be curious to hear how it works for you. And I hope it's as interesting and successful for you as it's been for me.
I'm sure it will be at least interesting.
Well, that.
If nothing else. I'm absolutely fascinated by it.
Totally. Good.
So thank you for that practice. Drawing joy.
Thanks, Susan.
All right. Bye-bye, Elizabeth.
Bye.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at pianina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in Peace and Nonviolence in Action.
Attention, Doomer Alert. If you see an attempt to assert any future news which ignores collapse views, it's no use and will only divert. The key to improving your mind is avoiding distractions you find. So focus on this, figure out how to kiss goodbye to your cherished behind. When I lived in a womb, a mere sprout, I knew not what life was about. If I'd known as a fetus what's out there to greet us, I wouldn't have ever come out. For dealing with doomer dismay, there are options from Freud to AA, which sounds very nice, but despite all advice, you still have to find your own way.
Speaking of finding your own way, I'd like to return to the topic of your new book, Limericks of Doom 2. One would guess from the title that there is also a Limericks of Doom 1. And when was that released?
Limericks of Doom, the original book was in 2014. That went pretty well as far as a self-publishing effort.
You say you self-publish your books, and I'm curious about that since you've told me you're acquainted with a person who's a professional literary agent. What made you decide to self-publish? And if you were granted a do-over, would you make the same decision? Why or why not?
My previous agent had no interest in this book, which had no possible future earnings. And so I was left with doing it myself, basically, is how I did self-publishing.
Was that with the first one back in 2014?
Yeah, and the second one. I tried to contact him again, and no dice. I did it with this company called Create Space, which is a subsidiary of Amazon. And they're really tremendously supportive and wonderful when you call them up and they offer help with your editing and so on. And the first book went very smoothly, although I called them probably 30 times at least for advice. And they were always nice. The second book I could format more easily because I did it exactly like the first one. And I'd gone through all the agonies of figuring stuff out the first time around. But I did run into some glitches. One was that I had to prove that I was actually the author of these poems, which I did by linking them to my blog. There were some other problems, but the book got up there okay. I decided to make the book more available by putting it on Kindle and also the first book. And the first book, they Kindleized it exactly the way the paperback is. And the second one, they just seem to have no end of trouble understanding the words, do it like the first one, do it like the paperback version, just make it the same. That somehow, through some bad luck, I got a different person working on it than on the first book, and it was a chore. Maybe it's just that I don't know how writing normally goes, and these hassles are part of the deal. And I would use the same company again if I ever wrote another book, which I will not.
But you would recommend Create Space to other aspiring authors if they were to ask your advice?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And if you don't want to figure all this, I mean, they did all this support for me for nothing on the first book. But if you want to turn the whole problem over to somebody, you can just pay them some money, you know, depending on what chore you want them to do. I did everything myself, except I was exhausted by the time I got to the Kindle thing, so I paid them. But in the time that it took to get that straightened out, I could have invented Kindle.
So you said with the first book that you must have called them about 30 times for support. Did you always get to talk to the same person, or was it somebody starting over every time?
Well, it was always somebody starting over, but it was always a wonderful conversation. I mean, the questions were always different. How do I get a page break here, or you know, those kinds of technical questions was the kind of help that I needed, because I'd already written all the stuff and I'd already decided what to put in the book and how to arrange it. Then it's just a matter of formatting, but that's a big job. And it's a lot of work.
Formatting and cover art. I'm also very curious what kind of support you got in the area of, you know, just the cosmetics of the job.
The cover, they have something called Cover Creator, and they give you a bunch of options, general, you know, where the title is and so on. And then you can make it different fonts and you can make it different colors. And when the book gets too big, then you write something on the spine of the book, you know, it prompts you for all that kind of stuff. I researched images, I think, before the first book, and finally decided on just a dark cover, just black. And actually, the typeface is supposed to be like typewriter print. So, and then I wanted the second one to match the first one, so there was no thinking to be done on that. I'm very pleased with how it turned out, as a matter of fact. I mean, I think that I present a comprehensive description of my point of view on pretty much everything, including Doom.
Including Doom. Not limited to Doom, though.
Right.
Not limited to Doom at all. I'm still curious to hear specifically, if you had it to do over, would you again decide to self-publish, or would you shop your manuscript around to different agents?
Oh, no, no, no. Nobody's going to buy it. But I think if I had to do it over again, I would probably pay somebody to do all of the formatting work. You know, just say, look at the first one. This one's set up the same way. Just make it happen. Yeah, I just pay somebody to do it, because it's just too hard, just too much.
The mechanics of it.
Well, I mean, just deciding which ones to include is a huge project, you know?
I hear that your readership is a very narrow and specialized niche.
Yes.
What has been your experience with getting readers and with your readership?
I sold about 67 copies of the first book in the 3 years that it's been out, most of it at the beginning.
Are those the paperback or the ebook?
The paperback. The ebook, okay. I think I sold one or two. But this book number two, I bought probably close to a half dozen books to send to people who had helped me with write it and so on, directly through Amazon. So right off the bat, I bought a bunch. And when I looked earlier today, I think only 12 total have been sold. So I bought roughly half of whatever has been sold. As far as the ebook goes, total, I think as of today, there's been a total of 12 sales, but I bought a bunch of them for friends whom I wanted to show my work, you know, for one reason or another. So I bought them ebooks, and I'm sure I bought at least half of the ebooks as well.
But so, it hasn't been out for very long, has it? When did it come out?
Well, it's only been a month altogether or something, but most of the sales come at the beginning. And, you know, I never expected that I was going to be selling. I mean, I didn't do it because I thought it was going to really sell a lot of copies. I knew it wasn't going to sell more than a handful. I thought maybe a couple dozen, and maybe it still will.
Does CreateSpace do any marketing and promotion on behalf of the authors who publish with them?
There's all kinds of marketing and promotion you can pay for.
Ah.
You know, since, as you said, the audience for this kind of work is so very, very small, it just doesn't make sense to use any of their services, because they're much more broadly. I mean, you know, Amazon has everything. If I wanted to promote it, I'd be doing it in much more specialized groups.
But you're not particularly interested in promoting it.
Well, you know, I'm ambivalent about it for a number of reasons. One of them being the well-known argument that the sooner people in general wake up, the sooner the bad shit hits the fan. versus the argument of people have a right to know and whether to tell them and how eager to be to tell them and so on. So being ambivalent about that to begin with, and knowing how hard it is to get a book like this out of the very small doomer bubble that we're in, it's not worth the time and effort.
Especially since, as you say, you're already exhausted from the effort of getting the thing Kindleized.
Oh, my Lord. Well, the whole project, I mean, it took several months to choose the poems because I was using everything that was new from the last 3 years. And that's been a lot of limericks. My blog, I think, has something like 1,500 limericks. And I actually went through all of them. It was a lot of work.
1,500 limericks in 3 years? No, your blog is older than that.
Blog is older, yeah. I think it starts in 2011. And it starts off with a bang because I had all kinds of stuff already written when I was persuaded to start a blog.
Okay, so any closing words for our sequitur listeners? There, we've been enjoying your piecemeal contributions for the entire year or so that sequitur's been on the air, and I'm just absolutely thrilled that you took the time, that you found the willingness to sit with me today and share a little bit about your creative process and about your publication process. And I'm wondering if there's anything we've missed that you'd like to add.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you for putting me on the air and the way you weave the limericks into conversations. I don't know anybody else who's ever done that, and it's pretty amazing the way you do it. So I'm just tickled pink with our collaborative association.
Well, thank you very much. And with that, we'll bid you good day. Thank you, Benji.
Hee-haw!
Bye-bye now.
Hee-haw!
Elizabeth West also self-published her book, Love is the Way, now in its second printing. Elizabeth, you told me someone else helped you with that professional relationship, but I'd still like to hear your reflections on the same questions I asked Benji. What made you decide to self-publish? And if you were granted a do-over, would you make the same decision? Why or why not?
I am overall very satisfied with the decision I made. I chose to go with a self-published book because I had some information that I wanted to share. I wanted to share it as it came through for me. And as you know, it's channeled for the most part. So it's not something that I wanted to put in an editor's hand to be ripped apart. It came through as it was meant to be offered. And, you know, other authors may feel that way about what they write as well, even if it's not channeled. And I was able to produce the book and share it almost as quickly as I was able to download the content. And when I say download, I don't mean on a computer. In other words, it was quick, it was direct, and I had control over the content and to a certain degree over the formatting and presentation. I would imagine that a professional publishing house would be able to access other formats and to be a little bit more finessed in that regard, but I was fairly pleased with the look of my book, and I also really like the fact that I'm able to distribute it in different channels. So the publishing platform that I used is CreateSpace, which I think is the same one that Benji used. I liked the fact that it was easy to use and easy to edit and update as well. So as I had corrections to make or new things to add, it was pretty simple to do that. But also, because CreateSpace is a child of Amazon, which has its drawbacks, it also has its advantages. And the advantages that I see chiefly are the reach. Amazon has sites of the world that deal in different currencies. And I sell a bunch of books in Japan, actually, interestingly enough. That's an easy thing for me. I couldn't do that on my own.
Even though it hasn't necessarily been translated, it still gets sold in these other countries.
Exactly. Strange. So in addition to the Amazon channel, which is just there, and part of the CreateSpace deal, and Kindle, which is another part of the Amazon CreateSpace family. I can also purchase the books at a very reasonable cost and then become my own salesperson. I can take them places. I can gift them to people. I can sell them myself. And, you know, that's a little more cumbersome in terms of mailing them and so on and so forth. But I like having the opportunity to both allow my book to just sit there on Amazon or be able to send people to it on Amazon, as well as having the capacity to sell it myself directly or to take it to bookstores. One of the drawbacks is that CreateSpace is not a publisher that is recognized by a lot of bookstores. They do not work with CreateSpace. I've several times had bookstores been interested in carrying my book, but CreateSpace is not one of their suppliers. I've been able to work out consignments and things like that, or they'll buy a group of books from me and sell them, and then they'll buy another group.
Would you recommend CreateSpace to other authors? Why or why not?
It depends on what your goal is. Overall, I've been very happy with it. It doesn't have the status, of course, of HarperCollins or Bantam or something like that. When you publish your own book, people say, oh, it's self-published, I see. It implies that the book might not be as well vetted. But if you feel good about what you're doing, if you feel impelled to share it, and you feel up to either the editing and proofreading, or you can find somebody to do that for you, which I strongly recommend, I think it's a perfectly reasonable way to share what it is, your message, your ideas, your gifts with the rest of the world.
So I think if you go with a professional publisher, you get a wider readership, yes?
You do, and you get support for the promotion and distribution of the book, because of course, the publishing house has, what do they say, skin in the game, right? Uh-huh. They need the book to sell, so they are going to make sure that the book sells on their own behalf, but you benefit as well as the author.
That's the flip side of that credibility issue we were just talking about with self-publication. On the one hand, you don't have the reputation of this publishing house. On the other hand, you don't have to make them any money either.
You don't have to make them any money, and you don't have to make the compromises that they deem necessary to make money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, your control over your content is complete, which is important to a lot of us who write.
So you pointed out that you and Benji both used the same self-publishing support tool. Benji has a very flat cover, and you have a piece of original artwork on your cover. Would you talk a little bit about CreateSpace and cover selection?
Yes. I felt reasonably satisfied. I mean, I had a picture in my mind of what I wanted to do for my cover, and I was not able to do what I had envisioned with CreateSpace. However, they did provide me with a fairly large number of templates and the ability to manipulate and work with those in a personalized or individual way. I actually did that part myself, and given my lack of technical prowess, that's saying quite a bit.
So that cover is actually a painting that you did yourself?
There is a template that allowed me to put an image on the front of the book, and I chose to put a painting that I had done on the front of the book. This was a template that enabled me to put an image on the front cover, and it gave me certain parameters in terms of the text that was on the cover, on the spine, the font. And as you noticed when you looked at my book, the color of the font on the back cover is challenging. And that was a piece that I could not resolve within the confines of this program. So there's a drawback, right? I mean, I could see that this blurb on the back was going to be somewhat challenging to read because of my choice of font colors. The choice on the front and the back had to be the same or something like that. But overall, I found that to be not a huge, huge drawback. I would have appreciated having more options there, but it didn't kill the deal for me.
Well, okay. So in wrapping up, is there anything, any parting words you've got for Sequitur's listeners, any of them who might be considering trying to publish some of their written work?
I can say I think that breaking into the traditional publishing world is hugely challenging. You know, some people fall into it, some people are ushered into it, but getting in with an incredibly good, useful, groundbreaking, entertaining piece of work, whatever it happens to be, is not as simple as it should be, probably. And I think that self-publishing is a real boon for all of us because there are more books available, there are more ideas available, and we don't have to get through the kinds of gatekeepers who are thinking about the economic impact of a book, as well as hopefully the artistic or scientific value of a book. So I would really encourage people to look into it. And, you know, I'm not going to give CreateSpace a huge plug, but I think it has an ease of use and it has a pretty good reach. I'm open to hearing about other self-publishing platforms, but I have been happy with this one.
Okay, well, stay tuned because just a few weeks ago, we had Susan Aaliyah Terry on Sequitur Sacred Reciprocity to talk about the solar eclipse and also about her self-published book, Coming Darkness. Susan Aaliyah, I'd like to hear your reflections on the same questions I asked Benji and Elizabeth. What made you decide to self-publish? And if you were granted a do-over, would you make the same decision? Why or why not?
Well, actually, I went with a independent publisher that is kind of in between the realm of self-publishing and traditional publishing. The major difference is they take care of the covers and the formatting and just getting it out there. And then I take on part of the responsibility of marketing. So I've got my foot in both worlds through Creativia. So it's not solely self-published. It's not solely on my shoulders alone. And I'm really, really content with that. I would do it again. I would definitely do it again because one of the things about traditional publishing, if you find an agent and if they find you a publisher, is that it'll take up to 2 years for your work to see the light of day. And that's a long time. You know, it really is. I mean, granted, you'll probably get an advance of some sort, but then it's 2 years before your book comes out. And then you have to basically pay them back the royalties through the sales. So who knows when you'll actually see any money out of it. And that's the downside. Whereas going through Creativia, that's cut down to a couple of months, really, from your signing the contract to them getting your book out to the world. And doesn't cost you anything.
And when you say they take care of covers, do they send you like proofs or something?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. For Coming Darkness, they asked, you know, what I thought I wanted the cover to be. And I had a very vague idea. And they said, well, take a look at some stock photos. Let's see if we can find us a Lucifer. Let's see if we can find us a guy. It was a very hands-on process with a lot of back and forth. And I said, this is kind of my idea. And they said, okay, how about this? And I was like, oh my God, that's gorgeous. You know, if it was left up to me, I have no idea how crappy that would look. So just having them take on that and just giving me a really, for as far as I'm concerned, polished product was worth everything.
Did you have a particular person that you would call or were you dealing with different people every time you had a question? Or
no, it's a very small operation. So I was dealing with one Mika Hanlia, I think I said his name right, who runs it. That was nice. It was very personal. I never felt like I was just one of the guys rowing the boat. Even now, I can email him with a question and he'll get back to me. It's not a set it and forget it kind of thing.
And do they consult at all in the creative process or is it strictly the publication process that they're interested in?
Well, what I like is that it's really up to you. I had questions about, I was torn between calling my wares when I abbreviated werewolf, where, W-E-R-E or W-E-R. And I was like, what do I do? And he's like, well, you know, it's really up to you. However, whatever your artistic vision is what it is. And it's like, oh, wow. Oh, you know, and then I had to really sit with that and go, okay, what is my artistic vision? You know, and I really liked that kind of autonomy. I didn't have somebody saying, well, you know, traditionally, blah, 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 and maybe traditionally doesn't work.
So you've been talking about some of the things that were really wonderful about Creativia, a hybrid between a publishing agent and a self-publishing assistant. Were there any drawbacks that you would point to?
Well, you know, I think the biggest drawback, and that's the drawback of self-publishing, period, is that your books will not necessarily end up in a bookstore. And who doesn't want to see their book in a bookstore, right? And I'm assuming that if you go with a traditional publisher that they will, but when you're self-published with a hybrid like Creativia, that's not a guarantee. Then that might not ever happen. And that all depends on sales. And it also depends on finding a distributor that takes returns. So, you know, if your book gets in a bookstore, you need to have a distributor that will guarantee they'll take those back if they don't sell, which is a problem. So that's probably the biggest drawback.
Getting back to advantages, you mentioned on Sequitur Sacred Reciprocity that a story of yours had appeared in a Creativia anthology.
Yes.
How does that work?
One of our authors, Natalie Case, came to Creativia with an idea of gathering Creativia authors together into an anthology. So she came up with the theme, which was Nobody Gets a Happy Ever After. There are no such things as fairy tales. And a bunch of us just wrote on that theme, wrote little short stories on that theme, and they were collected under an anthology called, I want to say it's Broken Dreams. There's the anthology name. So it's really a showcase of Creativia authors.
It was organized by one of your colleagues, not by Creativia?
Not by them, no. See, that's another thing that I kind of like about this small community of authors is it's like, we have an idea. Well, okay, let's just run with it. So it's communal and it's supportive in that sense. You know?
I'm absolutely amazed that you even have access to each other's contact information.
We have Facebook groups. We are like connected.
It's very, very different from self-publishing, isn't it?
It really is. You know, you feel like you have this resource, this little family that if you have questions, somebody has most likely had that experience. Or, you know, if you need suggestions as to how to find reviews, somebody else can come to the rescue. So yeah, it's a little community.
It's access to a network as well as to a publication infrastructure.
Exactly. So,
well,
yeah.
That's very cool.
It is.
Is there anything more you'd like to add before we wrap up here?
Well, hopefully around December or so, possibly the beginning of the year, the next Creativia anthology will be out. I don't have a title, but that theme will be around a clandestine meeting at midnight.
Uh-huh. Oh, right up your alley. Can my listeners just Google Creativia?
They can go to creativia.org and learn about the publishing side of it. And there's links to all the authors and their books. And they can.
Oh, my goodness. And that's Creativia, Creativia, right?
.org, yes.
While we're on the subject of coming darkness, I think some of Benji's limericks might have been written by your Lucifer himself. Listen to these reflections on human nature.
Morality. Morals are consensus trance tools for socialization schools. But we'll learn jungle law read in tooth and in claw doesn't honor our ethical rules. Is it wrong that the righteous are righting? Are the holy and good evil smiting? Is it some noble cause in support of just laws? No, it's just animals fighting. Alliances. To prep for our coming rough landing, we use temporary group banding. At first between nations, then smaller locations, until it's the last person standing. Hee-haw!
Well, thank you very much for taking time out of your workday to meet with me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
I look forward to further developments in Lucifer's reality.
Cool.
I am not prepared to believe he is dead or even that he could die. Yeah, he's my fave. I always did have a weakness for the bad boy. In any event, I sincerely hope that he is the last one standing.
You know, one reason to not put off fun
till a future when work is all done. It will mess with your mind as soon as you find we're not going to be having one. Hee-haw!
In other words, celebration helps with acceptance. A shout-out to Peter Melton is in order here. He recommended the 2014 feature by 20th Century Fox titled The Book of Life, a computer-animated musical set during Dia de los Muertos, directed by Jorge R. Gutierrez. Writing for Polygon earlier this year, Allegra Frank describes the film as, quote, an authentic love letter to one of Mexico's most iconic celebrations, unquote. I saw it last year and will make the screening an annual event in my honoring of my beloved departed. How will you celebrate Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, or All Souls' Day?
Make the most of each day, it is said, with the time left before we're all dead. Well, I've had it. The stuff that I've done is enough. I say fuck it and go back to bed. Yeehaw!
I'm going to celebrate in community this weekend. On Saturday at noon, there's an annual ancestor vigil I like to attend at Raven and Crone, our local pagan bookstore, gift shop, cafe. Then on Sunday at 6 p.m., the newly formed chapter of the Circle of Unitarian Universalist Pagans is offering recognition to our beloved dead. I am neither a Unitarian nor a Universalist, but I am most definitely a pagan. So I found a ride to the UU Church for the Cups event. But for Sequitur All Souls, I am offering a reading of the names of a few of the souls who have faded through the ever-thinning and somewhat tattered veil this past year. They fall into three categories: beloveds of mine or of those close to me, an example of an untimely death at the hands of an increasingly fascist state, and musical icons. But before I read the names, I will play a topical song by my late music partner C.W. Conrad, who died of lung cancer on 1 February 2008 at the age of 56. Fittingly enough, it is titled Died on the Vine. It was recorded by Dan Williams at Flannel Biscuit Bakery Studio in Madison County, North Carolina, and published on the 6th anniversary of Conrad's death by backup vocalist Trisha Boyd. As you listen, turn your attention to your own departed dear ones, and if you dare, make yourself available to them to see if they have any requests of you or gifts to offer.
At times when I stood all alone in the rain, times when I thought that I would die from the pain, and I've seen that the past is just yesterday's dream, I found that the truth is not what it seems. And all of the things that have died on the vine, all of the hope I couldn't find, and all of the love that just wouldn't stay, waiting for things I couldn't say. In the night of our silence, waiting for day, the sound of the wind cries, you won't stay. You walk towards the sunlight and you forget me today, letting my hope and our love slip away. And all of the things that have died on the vine, all of the hope I couldn't find, all of the love that just wouldn't stay, waiting for things I couldn't say. life is so short and death is so long. Smiles are so swift like the words of a song. Though they're forgotten, they've been sung to the wind. It travels around us and comes back again. And all of the things that have died all around, all of the hope I couldn't find, and all of the love that just wouldn't stay, waiting for things.
Beloved theater mentor Hazel Robinson died October 2016, age 90, cancer.
Times when I thought that I would.
Beloved Transition Towns mentor Catherine Sutton died December 2016, age 67, heart failure. Dominica Bianca, beloved friend and spiritual mentor to my beloved Elizabeth West, died October 2017, age 56, organ failure. Bob Brown, beloved father to my beloved Paul Brown, died May 2017, age 95, natural causes. Jordan Edwards, shot by a police officer in the back of the head in the passenger seat of his friend's car as they were leaving a party in April 2017, age 15. Antoine Dominique Domino Jr., known as Fats, arguably the founder of Boogie Woogie Rock and Roll, died October 2017, age 89, natural causes.
All of the things that have died on the line.
Thomas Earl Petty, singer-songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, record producer, and actor, died October 2017, age 67, heart failure. Walter Carl Becker, musician, songwriter, record producer, and co-founder and bass player for Steely Dan, died September 2017, age 67,
and death is so long.
Organ failure.
Smiles are so swift like the words.
Glenn Campbell, singer, songwriter, guitar player,
they've forgotten. They've been
died August 2017, age 81,
travels around us and
Alzheimer's,
comes back again.
Rest in peace, beloved departed.
All of the things that have died on the vine, all of the hope I couldn't find, and all of the love that just wouldn't stay, waiting. I couldn't say, hey, 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 hey.
You know, each year the end seems so near, we're sure that we'll soon disappear. But despite all the tries at contingent goodbyes, the next year we're still fucking here. Next year, if the fates permit, we'll be gone, save for our obit. And unlike hitherto, we won't have to go through another year more of this shit. Hee-haw!
And that pretty much wraps it up for now. Thanks to contributors Elizabeth West, Susan Aaliyah Terry, and Benjamin the Donkey for their reflections on do-it-yourself publishing. And special thanks to Benjamin the Donkey for help with hosting the show. Thanks also to the late C.W. Conrad for Died on the Vine, and to Patricia Boyd for uploading it to YouTube, and to Zimpt
for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
What connects us is one.